Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle Radio, the show all about inspiring people, innovative companies and fresh ideas in global business. On today's episode, we're in the United Arab Emirates to explore the future of seafood. First, we'll meet the co-founder of a digital ecosystem connecting suppliers and buyers in the seafood supply chain to ensure transparency, sustainability and security throughout.
We've built tools for the hospitality industry to audit the seafood that they're procuring. And we've been so fortunate to roll out some of the first seafood traceability audits for large, forward-thinking hotel groups.
And later, we'll hear about oyster farming in the UAE amid a growing demand for secure and responsibly sourced seafood.
From a food security point of view, from oysters, we are now at a sort of production levels where we could supply the UAE entirely.
This is The Entrepreneurs with me, Tom Edwards. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs. Fahim Al-Kasimi is the co-founder of Seafood Souk, a digital marketplace that serves as a platform connecting seafood buyers and sellers around the world. Fahim started the company in 2018 with Sean Dennis, with the aim of revolutionising the global seafood industry by improving transparency, traceability and sustainability in seafood supply chains, and to ensure better fish reaches consumers worldwide. While attending the recent Sustainable Cities in Action Forum in Dubai, I had the pleasure of catching up with Fahim, and he began by telling me about the start of the journey.
Seafood Souk was almost created a little bit by mistake. It was about 5 years ago where a friend of ours who has an oyster farm spoke about the challenges of bringing his product to market. And over that dinner, we thought about how often, and I ask you listening in now, how often do you ask where your seafood comes from? And we identified a need for more transparency and traceability to build a blue economy. The reason this matters at events like today's in Sustainable Cities in Action is cities are the big consumption centers of the world, and they are the economic drivers of the world. But they are sourcing food that we eat within our cities from sometimes places quite far-flung and quite far away. And while we eat a large number of things, one of the things that the world does consume as a key protein is seafood. And while you might ask your waiter where that steak came from or where your chicken might come from, very rarely do we actually ask in a restaurant, where is this piece of fish come from? And usually it's quite far removed from its original state by the time you eat it. And I'm not talking about fish fingers. I'm talking about things like a fillet or a fillet of sea bass that you may be eating. And seafood is quite unique. Seafood is unique because it's the only protein, the only food source, really, that we still extract from the ocean, hoping to come back next year for more. Everything else we farm, 50% of seafood we farm today, but the remaining 50% is still wild caught. And there, governments have tried to regulate, but IUU, illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing is still an issue. Coming back to your question, which I'm not trying to deflect, is that we as a company build technology to build transparency throughout that supply chain. Whether it starts with fishers, we've operated with Poland Line Fisheries in South Africa and built them digital logbooks to help build that traceability at the start of the supply chain. And in very innovative cities, in the Emirate of Dubai, for example, we've built tools for the hospitality industry to audit the seafood that they're procuring. And we've been so fortunate to roll out some of the first seafood traceability audits for large forward-thinking hotel groups.
And what strikes me as interesting, and this is a narrative that we keep coming back to actually throughout this conference, is that often the forward-looking fixes are available locally. This might be about sourcing the materials to build and build innovatively. Or here, this mix of tapping into the story, the provenance of things, the availability of that technology locally, and the solutions are not always far flung. But this maybe taps in, if I'm to a broader interest and part of your some of your other remits that you occupy, which is that we need to marry up these big global challenges with often local fixes, because that is in itself more sustainable. Do you think there is a tendency to always look without and look from beyond borders, when actually some of these fixes are and should be available much closer to home?
I think there's two ways to answer that question. One, yes, I always recommend to any economy in the world, any city in the world, is to support that local entrepreneur first. It's a lot easier for you with the resources you have to sell to the businesses or to the consumers within your local market first. And we were very fortunate that we built these tools in this tourism center, you know, this global tourism hub that is the Emirate of Dubai. On the other hand, one of the reasons that I was quite excited about founding Seafood Souk with Sean Dennis was, I said, if we do this, can we promise to do one thing? And he said, what's that? I said, can we innovate from this region for the world and not have to look for innovation abroad? And now the projects that we have done, as I mentioned, with Poland Line Fishing in South Africa or some traceability tools that we've built where we're having discussions in Central and South America, that excites me. That shows that we're actually building a product that has a real global fit and brings a huge amount of impact to the seafood industry and to fishing in general.
And talk to me a little bit about selling the story, if you like, because again, lots of the discourse over the past couple of days has come back to this idea that you still need to have the storytelling, the richness of that story to carry people along. There may be cynics or skeptics or those who fear, probably wrongly, but they fear nonetheless that they may end up becoming somehow disinvested because of the march of technology or how it speaks to a traditional industry. How do you ensure that, as well as the story of progress, technical innovation, you're also covering off that the human side, which is necessary, isn't it, in really developing a brand that has that deep resonance and an enduring quality?
I've had the sort of wide-ranging challenges that any entrepreneur would have, but I think ours have been quite acute with some specifically challenging situations because we operate in fishing. If you look at some of the most politically active groups in the world and think about, you know, your home country, fishers are usually the most politically engaged. I won't go into details of the politics there, but it does mean that as we built a technology tool that would support businesses being more conscious of their seafood procurement, we also had to consider the political sensitivities of the tools that fishers want and why he or she may want to use these tools. I'll give you a few anecdotes that'll help clarify this. For those listening, this is helping you understand that the next time you're in a restaurant eating a piece of seafood, this is usually the supply chain that is behind it. When you build a digital logbook for a fisher that looks like it's going to be more work for them, you have to show where you're bringing value to the fishing community. And for us, what we've noticed now was that they've gone from paper-based logbooks to a digital application that integrates with their Ministry of Fisheries, in the case of South Africa, that has allowed them to sell their product, maybe not always for a higher price, but definitely quicker. And that has built quite a lot of transparency. I'm very thankful as we walk further down the supply chain how supportive the distribution network was here in Dubai, where the distributors of seafood, and these are the people that then source aquaculture and wild-caught seafood and sell it to your hotels and sell it to your processors or your catering companies or even to supermarket retail, how quickly they wanted to show that they were good actors and they weren't cheating anybody in the supply chain. And the more traceability they had, they could then showcase to their business buyers, we are transparent. And it was the first mover of a hotel group here in Dubai that actually said, we've never done an audit. Can we do it with two restaurants? And we did two restaurants. The results were not stunning. And they've gone off and really rolled it out across their entire portfolio. And they have significantly improved in how transparent their seafood procurement is. Where I hope this will go in the long run is having consumers ask the questions. Our SFS Trace technology, our traceability product, can be put in QR codes on menus. The next time you're in a supermarket, if you're back in the UK and you go into a Sainsbury's, a Tesco's, a Waitrose, and you see a piece of fish, we could place a QR code on there to help those supermarket retail chains showcase how sustainable their procurement is and then feed back the information on what information these consumers are looking for. And I think it'll take time. Regulation is catching up, but we're super thrilled to be doing it from this part of the world.
In terms of great tech, smart ideas, and the readiness with which they're engaged with as they travel around the world, it is pretty difficult to actually look at this without that prism, of, as you mentioned earlier, of the regional politics, regulatory concerns, whatever it might be. How do you navigate that? Because presumably this resource should be available everywhere, but there's always going to be those different vested interests and so forth. You're also a diplomat by training, which I presume comes in useful, but tell me how, with your entrepreneurial hat on, you navigate that complexity, because it's complex, it surely is, right?
I'll be very undiplomatic and actually be quite honest, with difficulty. I think one of the most important skill sets an entrepreneur needs to have is resilience. And some of the most successful entrepreneurs that I've learned from, I'm fortunate to call some of them my friends, the one thing is having a North Star, remaining extremely focused on the goal, and ours is impact at Seafoodsuq, and sticking to it. If you get told no today, that doesn't preclude you from having that same conversation as regulation change, as the environment that you operate in changes, as people become more aware of these issues. I say this not because you've invited me, but honestly, the ability to tell this story is one step towards raising the awareness of asking for more transparency in food supply chains, requiring more provenance. And I'll give you a very, very simple example. We were working, and I'll try to be diplomatically correct and not state which city, but we were speaking to a city that wanted to promote local sourcing. And they said, could we build local sourcing strategies using your traceability audits to ensure and encourage hotels and retailers to source more locally? And I refused on principle to do the project because there wasn't enough transparency on the local catch for me to be able to encourage it. And I said, if you want to do this, you need to have transparency across the entire supply chain. I cannot encourage you to overfish the body of water that you were next to as a city. So it is iterative. It is about convening. It's about discourse. It's about collaboration. One of the themes of the event today, it's about collaborating with cities, with business partners, and saying, where are your challenges and how can we build technology to make an impact?
I can imagine a denizens of City Hall somewhere thinking, is there anything that's given the game away about the geography? I think, as you said, you were very diplomatically sound. Tell me a little bit about where this can go, because this story about provenance is something that's very of deep interest to Monocle, actually, whether you talk about the provenance of a product, the food that we eat, the seafood that we enjoy. Can the tech, can the logic, the rationale behind its success already extend further across, I don't know, other sectors? Could we end up with this kind of certification across literally every product? Or is that running way too far ahead of things as they go?
People tend to ask, why only seafood in what we do? And the truth is, we can do other products. However, there are other companies that are focused on it, or there are other regulations around certain food categories already. The reason we focused on seafood is twofold. Number one, because I'm just a marine conservationist, and I really do care about our oceans. And I think that's just helped Sean and I, both as marine lovers, really be resilient, because we actually do care. The other one is because it is one of the least digitized sectors, probably one of the last digitized sectors globally. The statistics that I usually lead with, 1 in 5 pieces of seafood that you eat is mislabeled, either by date or the product that you're eating. If you think about a fillet of fish that is a white fish, it's very difficult to actually go back in the supply chain and identify exactly where that source was and which ocean it was caught in, if it was wild caught. So we tackled seafood because it's a high-value product, extremely perishable, and very untransparent. And those were the three reasons we said this could work there. What will it take to have more adoption? Consumer behavior. Consumers need to ask more questions. Our focus on us as consumers of seafood, and we're in a part of the world today that has some of the highest seafood consumption per capita. Tourist hubs tend to be. If you think about going on holiday, if you're listening, you tend to that going on holiday to the Mediterranean, you suddenly realize your seafood consumption goes through the roof. And, you know, it tends to be tourism hubs consume more seafood. The second one is businesses themselves. They need to be the drivers of change. And I commend businesses that are on their sustainability drive, because sustainability with a capital S is so abstract. And there are so many elements in sustainability, whether you're talking about carbon cost, us, where we're focused on, which is biodiversity protection, preventing overfishing. They have so many things that they need to attack, or so many challenges they need to overcome, that we hope we provide a cost-effective tool, and they take a stance on that. And then last but not least, we've taken this polar approach to both sides of the supply chain. We also then need to build the tools further up the supply chain to be able to encourage it. You can't have traceability on the audit side as the end consumer and not build the tools for people that are supplying that value chain earlier on.
Do you think that some of those stakeholders you've described, I'm thinking particularly of, if you look at, say, big retailers of seafood, do they need a regulatory nudge? Do you think enough of them have the investment in the problem and the solution to do this on their own? Or do we need to kind of help them along the way a little bit?
We were very fortunate that we identified a protocol, for lack of a better word, a framework called the Global Dialogue on Seafood Traceability that highlighted some of the first key data elements that the supply chain should be asking for. We've seen the first mover in regulation in the United States of America, where the FDA has announced an adoption period starting 2026. Anybody importing seafood should abide by providing as much of the KDEs as possible. And we're not saying it's binary. What we say is this is how traceable your seafood is, and it encourages better decision-making. It's a journey. You can't say it is traceable or it is not, you know. So it's a sliding scale. The European Union, in their latest workshop that we attended, have highlighted that they're moving towards that direction. Whether they adopt the GDST or a similar protocol will encourage it. But coming back to the start of our conversation, cities are the economic drivers. For me, it would be food control authorities, food safety standard setting agencies in cities that could be the first movers to say, you know, us as, and I'll use the big tourism metropolises of the world, us as a New York, a London, a Paris, a Tokyo, a Dubai, we will set a standard to say that we should be promoting more and more of transparency requirements along the way.
Fine, just give me a sense in terms, perhaps finally, of the general direction of travel in terms of this kind of entrepreneurial innovation, harnessing technology to drive some really progressive businesses for this region. And that's whether we're here in Dubai, across the Emirates, in Sharjah, of course. Is there another untold story about the pace of change, the pace of development, the pace of that innovation? You said part of your founding principle, the MO, was that it had to be predicated on this being a fix from here for the world. Are there other companies that are now joining you in that vanguard that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, I think we're in the second cohort of some really exciting technology companies that are emerging from the region. I think we stress tested it with the first cohort that applied and adapted business models that were growing internationally and applied them to the region. And they've been extremely successful at that. I think today we have shown that we can do it. The capital is there, fantastic investors, venture capitalists that see the opportunity. And I think for us, we identified a problem that was acute in our own region. We are a coastal community. We have a fishing community. We eat a lot of seafood here. And we started here. But we weren't afraid to then go abroad and say, are you struggling with this as well? And we got, you know, nodding heads in the room that said, yes, this tool would work for us. I hope, you know, when people ask me, they say, why are you doing this? And yes, one is its impact on our marine environment. But the other one is, I'm getting a little bit older now. I just hope to inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs to say, think up of innovative ideas. Don't wait to copy somebody else's business model and adapt it for the region. It might be hard, but if you are diligent in your strategic planning, you can actually make a difference from here and impact the world.
I think I said that was my last question. I wanted to ask you about where you get your inspiration from then, because you're well-traveled, you've got feet in lots of different markets for different reasons, but you also said you're a man of the sea or a sailor, and you paint this picture of being sort of out on your boat. Is that the retreat for you if you need to find a solution to something very complicated, or maybe just get a moment of inspiration? Does that come when you're at sea? Is that your refuge? Is it an inspiration?
If for those that are listening that know my background, if I'm not on the water, I'm usually free diving in it. I'm a free diver and I work in sea turtle conservation. And whenever I need to take a step back from the busy world of business and wonder what I can do today to inspire my children, to be a great example for them, I'll usually go work at the Dubai Turtle Rehabilitation Center that Jumeirah Group has. And I work as their ambassador to help people understand more about the little things we can do on a day-to-day basis to protect endangered species. And that for me is, I guess what keeps me focused on impact and allows me to sometimes retract from some of the business challenges and think, well, I've saved a turtle today. At least that's one step towards making an impact.
That was Fahim Al-Kassimi, the co-founder of Seafood Souk. And you can find out more about the business by heading on over to seafoodsouk.com. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs. Remy Murray is the founder and CEO of Dibba Bay Oysters, the first and only gourmet oyster farm in the Middle East, located just 90 minutes drive from Dubai. Inspired by the nation's pearl diving heritage, Remy started the company in 2016 and pioneered the pivot from the traditional Arabian pearl oyster industry to focus on cultivation and harvesting an edible oyster species. I caught up with Remy at Expo City Dubai, and he began by telling me the origin story of Dibber Bay Oysters.
I came at this purely from an entrepreneurial point of view. I saw an opportunity with regards to food production because 70-80% of everything was being imported, and in particular seafood, because still at least 70% of all the seafood that we were consuming here was being imported, which I thought was pretty crazy since we're surrounded by the ocean. And so there was a lot of focus on different types of land-based agriculture in enclosed environments, air-conditioned warehouses, etc. What I was interested in doing was coming at it from a slightly different angle, and I wanted to be in aquaculture. I thought that that was the way to go. It was a completely undeveloped sector at the time, and as I said, lots of ocean surrounding us. So what I wanted to look at was to find, instead of altering the environment, find the right species for the environment. And I think because I'm not a trained marine biologist or a trained aquaculturalist, I came at it without any prejudices, without any sort of preordained ideas. And so I was just very much looking at what species could survive within the environment, and particularly on the East Coast. So I was focused on the East Coast because that's on the tip of the Indian Ocean. It's the Gulf of Oman. It's a very deep, very productive ocean. It's not like the Arabian Gulf, which is very shallow, very saline, very hot. So I focused over there, and I was just looking at... I arrived at shellfish quite quickly because if you want to farm something, shellfish generally are a fantastic candidate for sustainable farming because they will generally give you a net positive impact on their surrounding environment for a whole bunch of reasons. The primary reasons being shellfish will consume microalgae out of the water naturally. So you don't need to feed them anything. So you don't have that whole fish feed conversion ratio thing to deal with. Furthermore, with shellfish, when they grow, they're sequestering carbon in their shells as they grow. So they're removing carbon. They're not requiring the capture of wild fish to make feed, etc. So lots of boxes to tick there. And so then when, obviously, there was this amazing tradition here of pearl farming, or not pearl farming, pearl fishery, rather. It was wild capture of pearl oysters for pearls. Clearly, shellfish can do very well in these waters. And so what I did was I found the right species that could be introduced here that can be used for edible oysters. And then it was very much just doing a pilot, seeing if it worked. Normally, in cooler oceans, you get a lot of phytoplankton and algae in the upper water column. And so if you're farming oysters, you've got them in the upper water column, and so they can feed there. Mostly in hot oceans, you don't get the algae in the upper water column. But across on the East Coast where we are, we get this lovely upwelling from deeper water. And so we still get that algae in the upper water column. So that's not normal. That's quite particular to this region. Furthermore, I mean, we're bringing in baby oysters from hatcheries. They're on the upper level of their environmental tolerance, which means that they can grow quite happily here, but they won't go into a breeding cycle. So they couldn't be introduced as a species to live here, but they can be quite happily farmed. And so that works for me as a farmer. And so there was various factors there that allowed it to work.
Give me an idea of the scale. Extraordinary growth, just in terms of the numbers that you're...
Yeah.
I don't know what you call it. Growing, harvesting, whatever
yeah,
you call it.
Yeah, harvesting, yeah. So it was obviously, it was a fairly slow start because we had to work out what to do. We were using different farming techniques from all over the world. We were using a combination of the long line techniques that we're using, which is using horizontal taut lines under the seawater, under the surface. That is actually taken from Canadian scallop farming techniques. And then we were using some French techniques, and we had a look at what was happening in South Africa and Australia. And we were just sort of taking bits and pieces from all over the world. It's very Dubai. Just take what works from elsewhere and just sort of mesh it all together. And so then we put it all together, and then there was several years of just working it out. It was a bit of trial and error. And so even 3 or 4 years ago, we were producing around 20,000 oysters a month, and not consistently, much to sort of the rage of many chefs in town. the chefs always want consistency.
Yeah. They're very demanding like that.
Yeah.
But where are you up to now, then, numbers-wise?
Well, I mean, like this last December, we cleared 500,000 in
wow.
a month. So we're now averaging it 400,000 or 500,000 a month.
That's extraordinary yeah. numbers. And give me a sense what that means.
Between about a 40% and 50% market share locally So from a food security, I mean, obviously oysters are never going to feature hugely in a food security policy. It's more a nice to have. But I mean, they are full of protein. They're very good for you. But from a food security point of view, from oysters, we are now at a sort of production levels where we could supply the UAE entirely.
I mean, that is absolutely extraordinary. This business is, was that the product of those entrepreneurial instincts that you mentioned at the top and your other things you've done? Or is there a bit of serendipity? Sometimes there's a little bit of luck. These things come together. I don't know.
Oh, I don't think you'll find any entrepreneur on the planet that won't attribute luck to quite a few things. No. It was very much my approach. I've always been an entrepreneur. And so I'm pretty good at researching very different industries and taking what I need from different areas and sort of meshing it all together. And so it was a combination of that, of just being very neutral in that whatever works and not be that bothered why at the beginning.
Just get into the detail later. Look, so here is somebody who's got a relatively young business talking about meeting a nation's demand for a product. It's pretty extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
What's the growth
What's
story,
next?
The ambition?
Yeah.
Well, in a way, do you have to almost check yourself? And I guess there's going to still be a bit of a need to sell the story of this product. Because I guess you probably still do meet some surprise or skepticism in certain quarters. Is that part of the story?
I mean, there was a lot of skepticism in the beginning, of course, especially from European-based chefs that were working here that just didn't believe that you could get a quality oyster from these waters. I think we're well and truly beyond that, and so we're very well known in the market. But no, there's still ongoing education. I think what we're focusing on in the UAE, it's not so much taking market share from the imported oysters, which was the focus in the beginning. It's now about growing the market and getting more people interested in oysters. They had a pretty rubbish reputation, I would say, in sort of 80s, 90s, of just excess and just being this fancy food. Whereas I think now consumers are very interested in what's healthy, what is sustainably grown, and what their vitamin and mineral content is, as opposed to who's eating them where. And so oysters fit very nicely in that category of being, they're technically a superfood. They're so full of minerals and vitamins, they're so good for you, and they're one of the few foods that can be grown with an environmentally positive impact. We also have lots of other things we're doing, like we're taking back the shells from restaurants and we're building an oyster reef in the ocean across Indiba. So we're recycling the shells and creating marine environment. So we're ticking lots of boxes.
Where do we look out for you next? Are you kind of traveling the world to tell this tale?
Yeah, no, we started exports. So there's a focus on Asia, but we will be looking back at Europe as well. I mean, I think we've got a pretty good story to tell. And we also have this incredible transport advantage, because oysters are generally grown in pretty remote areas. And so to collect them and then depurate them and package them and then join them up, and because it's normally lots of, like particularly in France, it's lots of small producers and then they all form cooperatives and they have joint facilities. And so there's quite a lot of logistics involved with getting the oysters from the farm to the local markets, and then if they're exporting them, getting them across the world. So for example, oysters from France will maybe have been out of the water for 4 or 5 days by the time they get to Hong Kong. Whereas we are 90 minutes away from Dubai Airport, which is like the biggest fresh cargo transport hub on the planet. So we can do same day delivery to pretty much any capital in the world.
That was Remy Murray, the founder and CEO of Dibba Bay Oysters. And you can learn more about the business by heading to dibbabay.com. And that is all for this episode of The Entrepreneurs. We'll be back at the same time next week. Do look out for Eureka, available every Friday. The programme was produced by Laura Kramer, with mixing and editing by Tamsin Howard. You can listen again and find out more about the show at monocle.com. That's where you can also subscribe to the magazine and ensure you're reading more about better businesses every month. To contact the team, email Laura on lrk@monocle.com. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thanks for listening to The Entrepreneurs.